Hi, everybody. This is Dean Haglund from the Office of Irrational Exuberance here in the heart of the historic core of downtown Los Angeles in the middle of the Eastern Columbia building that is the Art Deco wonder that houses the Office of Irrational Exuberance, the home of your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with, as always, your friend in podcasting, my co-host, Mr. Phil Arnest, ladies and gentlemen.
I'm going low-tech today, Dean Haglund.
You have no laptop in front of you. How are you possibly even going to know what the show's about?
I printed out notes, actually, because I care about what's going on in the world. I care about bringing everybody.
But clearly, you don't care about the trees because you just printed on.
Look,
it's on the back of a screenplay. Fantastic. That movie sucks anyway, whatever that's on the back
of. In fact, I don't even have. Oh, this was, I think, the pilot episode of the TV series Southland. So it does suck. I don't even have any blank paper
anywhere
in my place.
Because you printed all the Southland scripts on it for some reason.
I'd stolen probably my body's weight in office supplies when I left Cinema Arts Entertainment in Artides, Paris.
Oh, right. That's
and,
what that
it took about 3 years to get through the paper, because who prints things anymore?
I know. Not and good, God bless they don't listen to this podcast or there'd be a lawsuit.
Do you know that I really enjoy using my Kindle, not for books. I mean, as I kind of suspected,
right.
I like reading actual books.
Yes.
With paper Kindle and everything. Yeah. Is terrific
for
PDFs, for scripts, for business proposals.
Oh.
Just slide them on over, or I can email them to my Kindle.
Look at that.
And use downloads. It's really a great business tool.
Well, hello, Kindle, for all your office needs. Are you getting
what?
Paid for by Kindle?
I don't know. But seriously.
Yeah. I have the same thing as Kindle, but it's got a keyboard attached to it. It's called a laptop.
Well, welcome to our worst show ever. And speaking of massacres.
Yay.
Too soon?
Yeah.
Boy, how do you make sense of what happened in Norway? Just a few weeks ago, we have a fantastic and charming and nice and personable Norwegian filmmaker on our show,
yes.
Stig Svendsen.
Yeah.
And you and I are so excited to go to Norway to be in independent films.
Yes. And then all of a sudden. Well, it's not all of a sudden, though. I mean, you know, these radicalization groups, they grow and... And as we could be, I think we're becoming bipolar as an entire culture.
Absolutely, we are because we live in such a dualistic way of thinking.
We either are right or left, extreme or too crazy liberal. You're either a hippie or
well,
a fascist.
I think
and
we
you're,
are so
no...
often reacting to something.
Right.
Whenever we're reacting, we've created some kind of polar tension.
Yes.
Reacting to something rather than responding to it, rather than asking, how does this serve? Apparently, this individual, for those of you who don't know, who've been in Comic-Con all weekend.
Like me.
There was a man, an individual, who set off a bomb,
mm-hmm.
killing seven.
In Oslo.
Then dressed up as a police officer, went to a resort island, and opened fire and killed at least 93. At this point.
That's, yeah.
And apparently from what he left for his rationalization, his motivation, he was very disturbed about the threat of multiculturalism and Islam. Now, I love threat of multiculturalism.
Right.
I mean, this is actually exactly what you're saying. It's almost like he's there to preserve the binary, to preserve the dualism of us versus them, as opposed to multiculturalism, which is, oh my God, there's too much.
Right.
There's too many choices. There's too many options.
Had he gone to Winnipeg ever, he would have realized that multiculturalism actually can work as a social phenomena.
Yeah, but I mean, when you hear even in this country, you know, all the anger, all the outrage of, you know, no, we're right, you're wrong. No, it's us or them. You know, you're either with us or against us. It's almost like they really do want to preserve the idea of with us or against us, right or wrong, right or left.
Right.
Because the idea that there might be a panoply of different views is the most terrifying reality of all.
Absolutely. And, you know, our documentary sort of touches on this in a way of how to have all these different views come together, particularly in the conspiracy world. And it was interesting at our screening last week that there was a woman who said, it's like beating your head against a wall. How she bought the DVD specifically, even though she saw the movie, she bought the DVD to watch it again to actually find the answer of how to get through this leftward right
paradigm.
This
woman was, she would not let go. Yeah, she was really clinging to this thing and kept trying to come at me with the same question. I finally said, you can ask me the same question as many different ways as you want to. You can just start saying the word fish sandwich and assume I know you're asking me the same question. But it really was, you know, it was, well, but what are you hoping to accomplish?
Yeah. And what is the point of this
document? And I kept getting back to this idea. It's to elevate conversation.
Right.
It's to restore possibilities. Right, but what do you want to accomplish? What fight are you? And I said, who says there's a fight? Well, there's fights all around. Oh, only because you're determined to see that there's fights.
Right. I know. That was very interesting. I don't know.
And indeed, you know, look, you are never going to piss off. I'm not saying that this is this one. This woman was lovely and really was asking, you know, some profound questions.
Mm-hmm.
But the truth is this. Look, some people are going to be very angry about our film. And let's leave our film out of it just for a second.
Right.
You know, there are a certain number of people that if you want to piss them off more than anything else, what will piss them off is to tell them that they can live life generously and that kindness and love and compassion actually do open all doors. Nothing's going to piss certain people
exactly.
off more than suggesting that we all be kind to each other.
Right.
After all, there was a guy a couple thousand years ago who got nailed to two pieces of wood for saying, wouldn't it be nice if we all were good to each other?
Exactly. Yeah, that can happen.
How dare you?
How dare
and
you.
Lo and behold, 2,000 years later, you know, in this country, we champion him by somehow,
killing a
saying
bunch of
that
people.
His message is you're either with us or against us.
Yes, that is binary yet again. So it's fascinating. I could see the frustration on people who see this sort of thing and descend into hopelessness. But at the same time, there is a documentary out there. That
do you know where my compassion goes? Really, I mean, obviously, your compassion goes with the survivors.
Yes,
of you know, the families and friends of these people who died. I guess because of, you know, the work that I did, violence prevention mm-hmm. work and education work and everything, a huge amount of my compassion, just my heart leapt out of my body for police officers everywhere in the world. Especially in Norway,
right.
in the wake of something like this, as if it wasn't a hard enough job and a dangerous enough job. And it's you know, it's quite popular in every country, it seems, to bash police officers. And you know, look, it's a very hard job, and it's supposed to be a hard job. The only way that being a police officer is an easy job is in a police state. It is supposed to be really, really difficult, really challenging.
Right.
And at the same time, these people put their they do, many of them, with absolutely the best of intentions and with integrity and authenticity, put their lives on the line to serve because they wish to serve their fellow man. And something like this happens, and it's like, dear God, it just became so much more dangerous for those people because, let's face it, everyone in Europe for quite a while, you're going to look at police officers a little bit differently.
Right, going, who's that? Is that his actual outfit? Is that a real outfit?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. It's once that infiltration has happened, that raises that level of suspicion.
You know, I there was a story that was told by a survivor at a rally, at a Denim Day rally several years ago, and this is the annual event. That you know, basically calls attention to women's rights and rape survivors' rights. And anyway, there was a survivor of rape who told her story at this rally. She was, like so many young women, raped in college, a freshman in college.
Mm-hmm.
And I was waiting for the, you know, it happened by someone in her dorm.
Right.
Turns out it didn't happen by someone in her dorm.
Oh.
So then I'm thinking, okay, well, it's going to turn out to be a college professor, right?
Right.
Wasn't a college professor. I'm thinking, okay, well, there's going to be a boyfriend. Well, it's not a boyfriend. It turns out that the person that raped her was the campus security officer that she had called to escort her home from the library one night where she was studying because, of course, she didn't want to get assaulted on campus.
Right.
And again, boy, can you imagine how hard it was after that to be a campus security officer?
Absolutely.
Your whole job is to keep these people safe, and because of what this other person did, now
you have to get,
no one's going to trust you.
You got to build that trust even more. Take it that further step.
It's phenomenal.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know, you know, if we lived to be 1,000, I don't know how you make sense of something
as crazy
like what happened in Norway. And of course, at the same time, what about this, you know, there as a metaphor for this binary way of living, how about the bullet train disaster in China this weekend? Bullet train slams into a disabled train, at least 36 dead.
Right.
And what I found so interesting was much like virtually every airline disaster, it was caused by inclement weather.
Inclement weather?
Lightning, I guess.
What?
And winds, heavy, heavy winds.
So it disabled the, because there's always a warning system on
I
the
think
track.
The warning system was disabled. Yeah.
Because of lightning.
Or high winds.
Yeah. Wow. Well, that just to go, you know, again, all our technology, our computers, our Kindles, all of these things are fragile electrical units, and it's, you know, one EMP pulse away from all of us going back to the little piece of paper you have right there in front of you. And all of this disappears.
If that happens, at least I'll be prepared to go door to door to deliver people their Chill Pack Hollywood Hour.
That's right. So please send us your address. No, I'm kidding. We're not.
There's a lot of talk about how this could, if you'll pardon the expression, derail the march to progress, the inexorable march to progress in China. They are developing these bullet trains like crazy, and not only developing them there, but selling them South America and
California may get one.
We've been hearing this for decades, and this would be the sad thing if it's like, you know, people manage to make hay out of this and say, you know, see, cars are safer, keep building roads, keep building cars. And
wouldn't that be?
And you know what's so funny is that we became such a motorist society. And it was tied in part and parcel with housing developments being built well outside cities.
Yep.
So that people would have to drive to them by a car. You make affordable housing far enough outside the city, then you're getting them to buy the car.
To come back to the work.
And to get the gas to come back where the work is.
But
wouldn't it be one of the best things? We keep coming back to how housing is so often the bedrock. It's referred to just the backbone of this nation's economy.
Right.
And couldn't a bullet train system really revitalize the housing market?
Well, theoretically, Manhattan survives specifically because it's a 24-hour subway system that circulates all those people living vertically. And I think that that could happen in any major urban development. However, did you hear in 1963, Los Angeles was offered a free, absolutely free monorail system from Seattle that was then shut down by Firestone and the oil companies. It would have been a free monorail that would have gone through downtown, would have been 40 miles plus, you know, would have gone to the beach. And then all of this is so disheartening when you hear that was just put aside. And now we're spending hundreds of millions to put it underground.
Never mind our jetpacks. I want my bullet train.
Yes.
I mean, imagine L.A. to San Francisco in an hour on a train.
Yeah. At 300 miles. You can't even go that fast on the 5. Yeah,
no.
And I've tried.
And talk about how hard it is to get in and out of airports. You can't fly it that fast.
No.
It's a 40-minute flight, but it's a several-hour ordeal.
Exactly. Weight, security, all that stuff. So how did we get here?
All the bad news, it just really seemed to be so many things coming to a head. I mean, I can't even begin to, you know, we talked about how here in Los Angeles there was that beating at the beginning of the summer, the beginning of the baseball season, rather, of that paramedic.
Giants fan,
right.
At the LA Dodgers game.
Brian Stowe was assaulted within an inch of his life by at Dodger Stadium. We'd known that he was in a coma and paralysis. Apparently, I don't know, you know, he's still paralyzed. He'll probably always be paralyzed, I guess. But, you know, I mean, he tried to mouth his last name, tried to give a thumbs up. So there is some recovery. But they finally arrested two people.
Right. After they arrested one other guy.
And charged them with these felonies, one of whom was already charged quite a while ago with misdemeanor battery and assault from earlier in the day at Dodger Stadium.
The same day.
Yeah, same guy. And but anyway, so the details of the report itself, as horrible as it seems that these two Dodger fans beat this guy into a coma and paralysis, that was the least of what they did to him. The complaint gets into very serious details.
Wow.
They cut out an eye.
What?
They attempted to cut off his lips, his ears, his nose, his tongue.
What? So this wasn't just a beating in the parking lot, hopping in the car?
No.
Oh. Wow.
How, I mean, what in the name of, again, that is so off the radar.
Yeah. Well, again, binary, right? You're Dodgers, you're Giants. This is left, you're bad. So all
and,
of that.
And one wonders at some point, look, you know, I love sports.
I don't.
No, you don't. I love it as a metaphor.
As a metaphor for citizenship and
teamwork. For the possibility in the excellence of the individual achievement, that possibility of truly unifying mind, body, and spirit in the moment.
As Coach Wooden would have said at the UCLA basketball team.
And you see the greatest athletes in their particular sport, whatever the sport is, and when you see them excel in the moment, you realize that they have managed what we all have the ability within us to do, which is to slow down time.
Right.
Which is to integrate mind, body, and spirit to achieve something that has never been achieved.
Okay.
And these things are potentially very valuable and historically have been valuable. And again, getting back to the idea of teamwork and the idea of competition and rivalry and how it fits in. And then you see the behavior of fans and it's almost like, you know what? No more games.
Yeah.
You know, at some point, if your kids misbehave too much while playing games, it's like, guess what?
You're not playing the game anymore.
You don't play games anymore.
Yeah. I agree. And that's what I've been seeing for so long.
It's a luxury. It's not a right.
Right.
And yet, it's a really, really, it's a money-making industry.
Well, exactly.
And remember, you know, when professional sports kind of first started, especially like football, which is the top moneymaker and the most important sport in this country, it wasn't. You know, baseball was far more popular for so long. Professional football, not until really the 1960s, was a moneymaker.
Right.
All of those were kind of club teams that were owned by corporations.
Right.
And people who worked at the company, worked in the steel factories, then went out and played for their club team.
Yeah, exactly.
It was like a semi-pro thing.
Semi-pro. Right. Remember that? Well, anyway. Speaking of corporations, I'm at San Diego Comic-Con this weekend.
Oh, well, wait. We're not done with the bad news.
Oh, there's more bad news?
Well, what about we've handled all the school closings, the train derailments.
Yes.
What about, we always do the celebrity deaths.
Celebrity death, Amy Winehouse. What a shock.
Everybody, was it a shock?
Well.
It's shockingly unshocking.
It's shockingly unshocking. I'm surprised she lasted this far, actually.
And yet, as everybody loves pointing out, you know, oh, what a weird coincidence that she died at 27 like so many other famous rock and roll stars. It was once pointed out, and it's staggering, the numbers on it, how the bulk of people actually die in a nine-year,
which is your Saturn return, isn't it? Isn't that your cycle of...
I don't know what
in
that...
In your horoscope, yeah.
You might be absolutely right. I just know that if you take the two digits, or single digit of nine, obviously, but if you take the two digits and add it up, that it becomes a nine, you know?
Yeah.
And so there's apparently really something to it. And
so entering the fourth cycle of a nine-year cycle, which should then be Saturn ascending.
Wow, look at you go.
Look at me go. That's right.
I first became aware of Amy Winehouse before she broke here in America. Of course, I've always been a big Anglophile, but saw her on the show that I mentioned before, later with Jules Holland.
Oh, yeah.
Band leader Jules Holland has hosted a long-running show on British television that is so great. It's In the Round, and it's just a bunch of different musical artists each week from around the world, and he just... And there's a live audience. They play live. There's no lip syncing. There's nothing. And he just wanders around the room introducing a group, and they play a number.
And it's on Ovation TV here in America.
And that's how I first saw Amy Winehouse.
Wow, that's pretty good.
I was blown away. I mean, just...
You bought her CD. It was the first time I heard it in your office, actually.
She was certainly a force of nature and... as is so often the case, truly living kind of an archetype that was sort of kind of controlling her. And it's an archetype we've seen many, many times with people in show business.
I know. You know, it was weird, though. Her place in Camden, Camden Town, it had no – I saw pictures when I was in London of all the paparazzi. Basically, her door opened onto the street. There was no garden. There was no gate. There was just – her door opened on the street, and they showed all the paparazzi basically camped 10 feet away from her door. And then this guy just went up with a guitar and knocked on her door at, like, I thought it was 12:30 at night. And she opens the door, all disheveled and stuff, and signs his guitar and just closes the door. So, like, anybody could have, her boundaries between public and private were, all seemed non-existent.
And yet nobody could keep her alive.
Well, because there were no boundaries.
I guess, you know.
Everybody, you know, at the same time, they go, how tragic. There was also that reveling in the British press of, like, oh, Amy's gone crazy again. Oh, you know,
right.
Her hair's on fire at a party or whatever. There would be, like, all of these stories that would come out almost
amazing
daily.
How those, like, rehab quotes, you know, from her song Rehab just
pop out
tweeted
now.
Like crazy.
Yeah.
Here's a celebrity death. I'm going to call him a celebrity. Great actor. A great actor died this weekend as well. And, you know, not someone that a lot of people are going to hear about or read about because he wasn't a music star. He wasn't young. It's not tragic in that sense that we think of as every young death. A great actor, though. Tom Aldridge, a five-time Tony-nominated actor. So did most of his great work on
the Broadway stage.
But a character actor that even later in life you would recognize from his work in Sopranos, Assassination of Jesse James, Cold Mountain, Coen Brothers films like Intolerable Cruelty, The Real Deal. And oh, by the way, did I mention a five-time Tony-nominated
yes,
actor?
You did.
He originated on Broadway the role of Norman Thayer, the role that would finally win Henry Fonda his Oscar in On Golden Pond.
On Golden Pond.
So this is the guy.
That
you know,
guy.
You know, we're not going to let him play the role in the movie. We're replacing him with Henry Fonda.
Yeah, right.
So think Henry Fonda of stage, and you get kind of the idea of the stature of this man. And I got to meet him in 2004 when I started shooting Karl Rove, I Love You, because he was appearing on Broadway with our friend Dan Butler in the 20th Century.
When you were shooting in the backstage area.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah,
that's cool.
Of course, was a real play. And he died at 83,
mm-hmm.
Lived a long life, complications from lymphoma.
Right.
And he was married to Theoni V. Aldridge, Oscar-winning costume designer whose name you'll see on so many great movies. She won an Oscar for The Great Gatsby.
Wow.
And she died a few years ago at 78. There's a quite the talented couple.
That's a powerhouse couple.
Yeah.
Wow.
So anyway, so, you know, it's I feel a certain sadness when someone like Tom Aldridge dies because, again, this is the man whose greatest work, and it was great, you know, it's bittersweet because mm-hmm. it's his best work truly can only be remembered through stories told about him.
Right.
And yet at the same time, in a way, one wonders whether that kind of helps keep
The mystique alive?
Someone, or keep a person alive.
Right.
More.
More than
just a film.
Because
it's not just an image on a screen. It's right. Not just the role they played. You are talking about the actor that played it.
It's true. Because, you know, a friend of mine said, you know, you could perform live and be the biggest hit ever. And the moment you stop performing, no one will remember you. You are within a generation. You will be stopped. Ruth Draper, excellent example. The leading influence for Laurence Olivier. A woman who traveled the world in the early part of the 20th century doing characters. She was one of the very first character stand-up comics you've never heard of. A couple recordings exist. She was making more money than Sarah Bernhardt, the actress of the vaudeville stage. And yet, Miss Draper's name goes completely unrecorded today in terms of comedy, character work, and all that sort of thing.
Well, I must admit that I kind of fall a little bit prey to this in that I was thinking about getting from Shout Factory the entire Lenny Bruce collection.
Ah.
And I paused because I wondered, well, do I really want this or will I just watch the Bob Fosse movie Lenny? And
exactly. I know. That's a good point because
He won't be forgotten because of a Dustin Hoffman movie and the influence, obviously. But I really didn't know whether I would want to invest in...
It's true because I was a big fan, and then the his last performance at the Hungry Eye in San Francisco has him basically reading court documents and then yelling at people outside the door.
That's funny. Actually, that makes me want to...
Want to see that after all?
Having now spent, as you know, some time in court, I would like to see that. Can you explain to me something? We didn't talk about this last week. This has been ongoing.
Okay.
The whole News of the World scandal with Rupert Murdoch, News of the World, the wiretapping in England. I mean, am I exaggerating to say that Rupert Murdoch, I mean, this really could be the undoing of Rupert Murdoch.
It could be. You know, he doesn't have a lot of friends.
I mean, it's a really kind of Charles Foster Kane, William Randolph Hearst, kind of tale, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, he got his start in Australia by buying up news. His dad was a newspaper man. He was given a newspaper, just as Kane was. But then he went around and he bought these newspapers, fired all the union staff, brought in things and just did wire service and put in naked chicks and basically owned Australia and worked his way out from there.
You know, he has issued simultaneous apologies on either side of the pond.
Yeah.
In Europe, in England, it's about the serious, serious mistakes that were made.
Yeah.
Here, it's about, well, that not really big deal that went on. And, you know, it's fascinating because he's quick to point out that News of the World represented less than 1% of his media empire.
Right.
And how fascinating the idea that something small, isn't that always the way,
right,
can bring these kind of people down.
Just like a game of Kerplunk.
It's what I witnessed in the court house last week that I talked about with that powerful lawyer. It is amazing how little tiny incidents, not that the wiretapping on News of the World is little, but I mean in the sense of this global empire.
Yeah.
This guy would seem unassailable, untouchable, but so often these people in big positions of power, we've talked about this on the show with sex scandals and this.
Yeah.
You know, first of all, if you are lying about little stuff in the scheme of your larger empire, you're probably lying about some big stuff,
exactly,
too.
Exactly. You don't have a problem with it.
Yeah.
You've found a way to sleep at night.
And if you're trying to cover up little things, knowing that you're too powerful for little things to bring you down.
Yeah.
I mean, fess up to the tiny little stuff. Bill Clinton with Monica Lewinsky, right?
Yeah.
If he had just marched in and just said, I did it and I admit it and now I've got work to do.
Yeah, hello.
So I'm going to get back to work.
David Letterman's a perfect example.
Look at the polls. Yeah. Everyone would have been well behind him. And instead, the obfuscation over something small and insignificant really leaves a bad taste because you kind of know this is operating procedure.
Absolutely. And then you have wasted an entire year trying to get to the bottom of that.
Now, I thought it was fascinating that the Wall Street Journal, of course, went
owned
owned by Rupert Murdoch,
mm-hmm.
and yet respected journalistically, certainly went to bat, doing a very thoughtful, well-written examination
right.
of it. And at the same time, though, I just can't help wondering, look, if certain practices were in play at News of the World...
Why aren't they in play at...
Well, could they not be in play elsewhere?
Well, yeah.
And aren't the vultures circling right now at Fox News?
Yes.
Because if any of this could be traced to another one...
Larger news core operational procedure...
Then it's over.
It's over. I think that that's probably the case. I mean, is it over? How much power do you have to change public perception? That's the thing, right? I mean, all of this is based on the public perception that this story got out, that this is highly insidious and, just apologizing by a one-page ad in the newspapers you already own doesn't really seem to me that you're that contrite. It seems to me that you just go, hey, I own all this media newspaper. I'm just going to apologize that it's all going to go away.
And if News Corp elevates Chase Carey ahead of him,
yes,
is that a big deal? Or is that just an in-name-only change?
Well, that's the thing. How does this whole operation operate in the first place? I've heard stories of the board meetings at Fox Television where Rupert shows up and he couldn't even give a crap about what's actually playing. They'll give him like rundowns of the next season and stuff like that. He goes, how much is it? And can we cut $100 million out of it? And they all go, yes,
sir.
See,
this was always the thing, you know, I mean, people talking about, you know, his conservative politics and the conservatism of Fox News and all this sort of stuff. You know, I always just thought, I mean, maybe he is an ideologue in terms of his personal life. He is truly a capitalist,
yeah,
through and through. And he found a niche, and he exploited that in the news world in this country and made a lot of money off of it. At the same time, he was also the head of a network that aired some of the most liberal programming.
True.
Because he found a niche.
I found a niche.
And exploited it to the
exactly.
tune of lots of money.
You're right. So at that point, I don't even think he knows what the programming is. Yeah. And same way... He doesn't know what the procedurals are at these newspapers.
And yet that's no excuse. That's no excuse.
Exactly.
Right? Because
that's
captain of the ship, man. You are responsible for the behavior of the crew under your command.
And you are the moral guidepost, theoretically, even if you're not explicitly stating it at every meeting you head to.
It's what drives me nuts about corporate climate, you know, again, giving the rights of individuals to corporations, yet you cannot give responsibility to corporations the same way you give to individuals.
Right.
Because you can't send a corporation to jail.
Right.
Right? You can only send individuals to jail. So the corporation might collectively as an entity have all the rights, but you can't chain that sucker up.
I know.
You can fine the company.
Right.
But you can't, there isn't the same ramification of responsibility. No, you have to find the people responsible for the wrongdoing. And listen to what I just said. The people.
The people.
Now it's not the corporation.
Yeah.
And of course, if I'm an executive and I can show plausible deniability, well then, yeah, I might be a bad manager, but I'm not criminally culpable. It's on you to prove that I knew what you think I knew when you think I knew it.
Right.
And there are too many people that will be fall guys that will throw themselves on the swords. It's no different in government.
Yeah.
And it's no different in
corporations. The Iran-Contra thing at Reagan. How did Reagan avoid that whole thing? He didn't know. And there was all these underlings under him, like Oliver North, that were smuggling cocaine for arms deal through Contra.
And smart quote-unquote leaders, let's call them elected officials, smart elected officials, will exploit that.
Yeah.
Plausible deniability instead of recognizing that a leader takes responsibility for everything that's going on underneath that.
But seeing the footage of Rupert Murdoch, he is old and doddering. I mean, he's fallen asleep at the meetings. He doesn't seem like he's the dynamic leader. You know, he's the same age as, like, Roger Penske, as a matter of fact, who I've heard on the phone. And that guy is dynamic, on top of the game, knows what's happening at every one of his dealerships with the race cars and the truck rental. He's got that corporation under control, in his head, knows about it all the time. Rupert Murdoch seems like the kids are running the show. Maybe his wife.
And unhappy kids. Because as we know, no, truthfully, yeah, of all the studios in town, if this is, you know, this is at least the prism through which we can view his business empire. Boy, Fox employees are miserable.
Yes,
even on
higher executive,
you know, levels. Even on that meter, that misery meter under which almost all studio executives work, studio employees work. I mean, it's all free massages, ice cream, and jewelry at the other studios compared to what goes on
totally
for the employees at Fox.
Yeah, so holy smokes, I say. Wow. I'm dying to see how that rolls out. Can't wait.
Now, speaking of misery and, and pain and lack of responsibility and massacre, how was Comic-Con?
That was the worst transition ever. Ha, ha, ha. Yeah, no, it was fun. Oh, my gosh. 3 years have passed since I've been there last. I went Saturday only. And you know what? The crowds have level of excitement has totally evened out. It wasn't jammed like it has been. It's packed, but not jammed where you can't move. And ran into
a
bunch of...
Is that because I don't know. It just seems to me it gets ever more corporate and less genre-based every year.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Glee was there. The new series that's Mad Men in the Skies called Pan Am. They had a big display.
It's just
there.
Pop culture.
Pop culture now. Yeah, yeah. And it's basically Hollywood connecting with fans from around the world. So people still go there and dress up in their favorite characters. You still have the comic book artist. You still have rare comic book artwork. All of that stuff's still there, but that's sort of shunted to the edges of the convention hall as the center is taken up by every media outlet that you could possibly imagine. That being said, hello, how did I get there 10 years ago but by the X-Files? So I can't really go, hey, this has changed when Fox brought me down. Hey, wait a sec.
Now you were there with Femme Fatales.
Femme Fatales on Cinemax.
Got renewed for a second season.
Renewed for a second season. Very exciting. Probably talk next week all about it.
Maybe. And spoiler alert, yeah, we will.
We will.
And were people excited about your film, The Truth Is Out There?
They were. Did you not see David Scroggie from Dark Horse putting a big shout out on his Facebook blog and saying that if we get to Portland, there would be some comic book support, and he would muster the...
There's a big radio show that wants to have us up there. So
look at
we got to get to the Pacific Northwest.
Let's do Pacific Northwest.
We've been talking about this for maybe November, doing a Portland, Seattle, Spokane,
Vancouver. Yeah, that'd
be good. We've got to hit Spokane because of our friends Peter Davenport and Brenda Roberts, who are in the film out there.
That would be
a little
lovely.
Something for them.
Yes, we go UFO watching.
I'm going to throw out some song titles that I saw... performed live,
okay.
Saw, performed live at the Hollywood Bowl. You tell me the artist.
Damn it. Okay. You know I'm bad at this.
Okay. Help by Messrs. Lennon and McCartney.
Uh-huh. Performed by...
Walking on Sunshine, made famous by Katrina and the Waves in the 80s.
Okay, so this is all the same performer.
And Stairway to Heaven. of course, made famous... by Led Zeppelin.
Yeah.
Which performer did I see that performed all of these numbers at the Hollywood Bowl on Friday night?
Rebecca Black. No, no. I know.
Also?
Liza Minnelli.
A lot of, you're getting close. A lot of bluegrass.
Oh.
Though equally as many, getting back to the Liza Minnelli reference, easily as many men shouting out, "You go, girl," during the concert as it would have been with Liza Minnelli.
Oh, Elton John.
I saw Dolly Parton.
No way.
National treasure Dolly Parton at the Hollywood Bowl.
What? What? I got it. Okay, what? How impossibly did you buy these tickets?
Two and a half hour show she put on.
Well, she sang Stairway to Heaven. I bet she could have cut that half hour if she just dumped that song.
No, she did like a 2 minute version of it. She was great. It was all like little snippets of songs and a lot of stories about growing up and mommy and pappy and the 12 other siblings.
The hills of whatever.
She is a national treasure. There is no, there is, I'm not just saying this. I'm
saying it.
Somewhat bewildered. I mean, I like Dolly Parton and respect her talent as much as anyone can without being a fan. I'm
right.
not a fan.
Okay.
I do. She is talented.
And, very good.
But I kind of get why she's this treasure. And if you are outside of LA, she's a huge deal. She really is a huge deal. And she's been a huge deal for a long time. And she sells out these huge venues everywhere. She's a brand.
She has her own theme park, Dolly World.
And it's that for all the funny, trashy appearance that she has, the trampy appearance, and she tells the story about that. Like, they would go into the town every couple months whenever any one of the kids was sick, and they had to go into the town. And there was the town tramp, the town hussy, would be walking around with, you know, the see-through heels with the goldfish in it and, you know, the huge wig.
Yeah.
And Dolly would say, "Mommy, she's the prettiest woman I've ever seen." Yeah. That is the town tramp, Dolly. "Mommy, the town tramp is the prettiest woman I've ever seen." And but for all this, I mean, when she's not doing Stairway to Heaven, when she's not doing Katrina and the Waves or Help or Tina Turner songs or whatever, when she's doing her own music, she really does drop into something incredibly authentic. And, you know, kind is such an undervalued thing. You can just tell this is one of the kindest people ever to take a stage.
Wow.
And in a country that loves ever more to identify itself as Christian, here's someone who's actually Christian, who advocates, you know, it is not upon us to judge other people.
Right.
It is upon us to love and accept everyone as beings worthy of respect for exactly what they are. And anyway, so, you know, I get it. I mean, I get why.
How did you even, did you buy these tickets? What, I mean,
I was arm candy.
I often think that I should buy you gifts, and then I go, "I don't know your taste at all." And then you throw Dolly Parton at me, and I'm going, "Well, no, I don't. I can't even."
Speaking of gifts, someone has a birthday.
What?
Coming up.
It's
Friday?
True.
Is it Friday?
It is Friday.
And you're going to be celebrating in Chi-Town.
Chi-Town, going to Chicago. Going to hang out. Might be on the Man Cow Show.
Right.
Wouldn't that be something?
That
yeah?
would be something.
Yeah, that's going to be fun. Another birthday in a hot climate. That's what it's going to be. I hope Chicago's 115 degrees.
Last week, we talked about all the big films of the summer thus far. We had another big superhero opening.
Captain America.
Captain America turned out not to be as successful as Thor.
Right.
Nor supposedly as good.
Because the fan base was all down in San Diego. Too busy.
That could have made enough of a difference.
Could have been.
Just enough, because it almost made what Thor did.
Right.
Though in my neighborhood, Captain America was supposed to open and then didn't even open because they decided, you know what? Movies like Beginners and Midnight in Paris are doing too well. We don't need another superhero
movie. Is that right?
Pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. That's something.
But what we really didn't talk about was The Boy Wizard.
Oh, yes.
Last week.
Crazy Harry Potter.
It all ends, Dean.
It all ends.
It all ends. Although, am I wrong in thinking that 20 years from now, she's gonna write another book?
I gotta think.
And that book turned into a movie will be the biggest thing ever, because you will have two more generations raised on the books and the movies.
Yeah.
You'll have everyone going to see a follow-up piece. It can focus on both their kids and on them, because they'll still be just 40 years old.
Right? Yeah. It would just be a classic.
And their kids can be in
Hogwarts.
I mean, it's just extraordinary, the possibility. And it's got to happen. It's got to happen.
I don't know.
At some point, don't you think these characters live with her enough that, I mean, just from a storytelling standpoint, you wonder, I mean,
I don't know. She's hungry. She's in a cafe. She writes out this whole idea. She pens all these books. She makes more money than the queen just off that. And then, really, you really got to go back to that?
Now, I read all the books, loved all the, not I loved all the books, but I love the series. There are some really bad books. There's a lot of repetition.
I hated the last one.
But I went and watched all the movies. Now, having known everything that happens, and, you know, after all these years of kind of trading off a movie with a book that's two books later than the movie that you just saw, and kind of that going back and forth, I finally just over 2 weeks watched all the movies again to kind of assess them as works of cinema,
right,
free from the books. And how did this play out? And, you know, it really is amazing because the most successful one, still financially, though, of course, the new one will pass it in the box office, but may not pass it attendance-wise, is the very first one. And it's kind of staggering that that will be the one with the most attendance, but not so when you think that it's really quite bad. And so a lot of people would see that and not want to see it again.
Yeah.
And I don't mean it's quite bad. I mean, it's pleasing enough if you like it. In fact, now I'm going to argue exactly the other side.
Yeah.
The first two movies are directed by Chris Columbus.
Right.
And the fascinating thing for me as a filmmaker, as a director, is that they kind of prove that if you have a well-constructed story with interesting characters, in other words, let's say good writing.
Yes.
And you cast it well.
Right.
It's almost director-proof.
Right.
Fascinating.
Fascinating.
Now, there is no vision. There is no point of view.
Right.
These movies are flat. They are not cinematic.
Right.
They're very much kids' movies. They're very perfunctory by the numbers.
Holy
but
smokes.
But boy, the cast on those first two, well cast. And again, the stories work.
Yeah. And apparently, you know, he can get performances out of kids. So.
I guess, although, you know, certainly not out of Daniel Radcliffe. I mean, again, this is the thing we've talked about before. You want to get a good performance out of actor, cast the right actor.
Yeah.
If you don't cast the right actor, it doesn't matter how great the actor is or how great the director is. The closest you can come is almost make them right for it.
Right.
Daniel Radcliffe looked the part. He felt the part. He could not act.
Right.
He, for most of the series, was well behind the development as an actor of Rupert Grint and Emma Watson. Emma Watson, everyone adores. Rupert Grint, you look at what he's been doing, you know, on IMDb, he's been hired far and away the most of any of these kids because he's got it. He's got the chops.
Right.
She, of course, is going to be starring in Guillermo del Toro's adaptation of Beauty and the Beast.
Yeah.
Because she's not only got the chops, she's got the look,
right,
too. But early on, you know, those two films, it really is fascinating. The writing and the casting, superb. And really, it's almost like with Chris Columbus, they just said, you know what, this guy's going to make sure the trains run on time.
Yeah, exactly.
That's what we want.
That's all you need. And that's all they needed because he had to set up the whole series.
But they really are rather blah as experiences.
Yeah.
Once you've seen them, you've seen them.
Yeah.
And again,
no need to go back.
For people who aren't aware of Chris Columbus and his track record, I quote the great reviewer Andy Klein,
yes,
who in a review of a Chris Columbus movie asked, you know, posed the question, you know, what's the difference between Christopher Columbus the explorer and Christopher Columbus the filmmaker? One brought plague and devastation and destruction to a native culture. The other discovered America. He was being kind. Now, the third movie is the one that had, of course, always been considered, rightly so, the cinematic crown jewel, the
right,
work of art, Prisoner of Azkaban. Not one of the better novels, necessarily.
No, really a transition novel.
And but directed by Alfonso Cuarón.
Yes.
Who, of course, we talked about Children of Men, one of our favorite of the decade. By the way, that was his last movie. He hasn't made a movie since that.
What?
2006 is Children of Men.
You're kidding.
It's been a long time.
I'm talking in a high voice now.
And before Harry Potter,
yep,
had done E Tu Mama Tambien,
oh, yeah,
drawing fantastic performances out of youthful actors.
Yes.
And it's the first movie of the Harry Potter series, where we truly enter a different world.
Absolutely, which was the whole thing about the books in the first place. Entering a different world. You could immerse yourself in this, and he was the first one to get that, it seemed.
And to whoever cast, and again, the casting, superb throughout the series. Whoever cast Gary Oldman as Harry's godfather, Sirius Black, escaped prisoner from Azkaban, That was genius.
And my favorite Gary Oldman. I love Gary Oldman performances. I watch them all the time, in the even the most obscure. And still, one of my favorites he's ever done.
I was actually toying with the notion, and this is a little hint at a production meeting that might take place later.
On-air production meeting.
I was actually thinking, given a very, very important in that we have, about Mr. Oldman maybe being in the next production from Rational Exuberance, Night Falls Fast.
Really? What the hell?
Anyway, the other casting bit that's interesting in Azkaban, of course, was that Richard Harris, for whom J.K. Rowling wrote the character of Dumbledore in those books,
right,
and who turned down the role repeatedly because he did not know the Harry Potter books.
Right.
He's, you know, a serious actor.
Right.
At the end of his road, I'm not going to do this. And his grandchildren talked him into it.
Right.
He, of course, died between the second and the third movie. And to a degree, the series was well served. Michael Gambon took a while, it seemed, before he kind of made the role his own.
Right. Really,
and where it kind of worked, where you weren't saying, oh, I sort of miss Richard Harris.
Yeah.
Because Richard Harris was perfect as Dumbledore in a kid's movie.
Right.
But as the series would grow and darken, the energy that Richard Harris had towards the later stage of his life was not sufficient. For the role of Dumbledore. He didn't have enough. There weren't enough teeth left in that old lion.
Right.
To really
fight the fight.
Sense that he was a truly powerful wizard anymore.
Mm.
And so it's one of those things where it's interesting how things work out. I mean,
right.
I'm always struck by in Star Trek, you know, the original captain of the Enterprise was Christopher Pike, played by Jeffrey Hunter, when the network ordered a second pilot, unheard of. Of course, they wanted to get rid of the guy with the ears and get rid of the woman first officer, right?
Right, right.
And, of course, as Gene Roddenberry always joked, he kept the guy with the ears and married the woman first officer because he couldn't do it the other way around. But they had every intention of keeping the captain.
Yeah.
Jeffrey Hunter.
Serena.
But he had priced himself out because he considered himself a movie star.
Well,
it's amazing how history plays out because, of course, Jeffrey Hunter died, I think, in 1970.
70, yeah.
And imagine that. So he would have been alive for the run of the show, if we could say that the show still would have had the same run. But there wouldn't have been all those big screen movies. There wouldn't have been the legacy. There wouldn't have been.
That
and, of
reboot,
course.
Yeah.
You know, Shatner playing Kirk was one of those magical things. But
totally.
It is just amazing how it works
out.
It
works
like
out.
That.
There is a grand divine scheme.
For casting.
For casting.
Certainly there is.
Yeah, for casting.
So Prisoner of Azkaban, truly, you know, the crown jewel at that point in the series. And as I looked back before I saw these, sort of expected that's the one.
Right.
Goblet of Fire, which followed, which was based on truly the great epic novel of the series, an amazing novel. It is a much better film than I gave it credit for when I first saw it.
Right. I recall you not liking it.
Because I was aware of how much was cut out. I had
wished
that they had done the two-movie version for that, the way they've done for Deathly Hallows.
Right.
But it was directed by Mike Newell, perhaps best known in this country for Four Weddings and a Funeral.
Yeah.
So he gets wonderful character performances.
Yes.
And it doesn't have the same level of magic, and it doesn't have that fantastic, seamless tone that gets weaved throughout it. In fact, that's the one thing that is my complaint about the movie, is that every act is really well done. And you are very aware of each act break. You don't enter the world and stay there. You're almost aware of the curtain coming down and taking an intermission.
And enjoy some popcorn and get back into it.
But still, given how much they had to cut out and given the size of the book, a really, actually, quite a nice accomplishment.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to watch that.
And then it's followed by the first of the final four, all of which were directed by David Yates.
Oh, yeah.
Order of the Phoenix. And this was the biggest thing he'd ever done. His biggest work prior to that was the HBO film, which you know that I liked, The Girl in the Cafe.
Oh, yeah.
About the Reykjavik G8 Summit.
Yeah.
Starring Bill Nighy, who, of course, would appear in one of David Yates' Harry Potter movies, Deathly Hallows Part 1, and also starring Kelly MacDonald, who has an incredibly important part in Deathly Hallows Part 2. So it's yeah, great right. that he called upon them.
Right.
But boy, Order of the Phoenix. Now, this is a film that you do enter another world, and it does have tone and mood and ambiance, and boy, is this a bad movie. It is unrelenting. It has great climactic scenes, but this is a director who at that point gets squashed by the tone that he has created.
Right. Cannot carry that through.
And it is, well, he carries it through, but it is unvarying. It is unyielding.
Right.
Just like a character must have arcs, as we've talked about before, so too must a tone
right.
have arcs and shifts in
right.
it. And that's the hardest part of telling any story. It, you know what doesn't have arcs often or tonal changes are commercials.
Right.
And often you find this as a mistake in, you know,
commercial directors
going into film. They and just know how to sell the one thing
exactly.
over and over and
put
over again.
Gas pedal to the floor.
And that's
just
what
run
David
that.
Yates does. He sells the same thing over and over and over.
Interesting.
In Order of the Phoenix. And that said, you know, I'm hitting him hard on this, and I'm doing so because the transition that he makes as a director from Order of the Phoenix to The Half-Blood Prince is an extraordinary leap.
Hmm.
Half-Blood Prince is a very accomplished film. That's the way
wow.
to describe it. And I would actually say, now looking back, it rivals Azkaban
really?
As the highest achievement hmm. through it. And one of the reasons for that is it's the one where Daniel Radcliffe truly comes of age as an actor.
Right.
He is an actor by this
pulls
point.
Pulls it in.
And it's a great performance by Daniel Radcliffe.
Ah, okay.
And
that brings
us to the two-part conclusion.
Yes.
Now, what was interesting was that next to Order of the Phoenix, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 1 got the worst reviews of the series.
Because it was all set up.
That's it. It
right.
You know what I like to compare it to is Kill Bill Volume 1 and Kill Bill Volume 2. Do you
yeah.
remember that the reviews for Kill Bill Volume 1 were sort of meh?
Yeah. So.
And then you see Kill Bill Volume 2 and
everything
not only
pays
is it
off.
Extraordinary, but you suddenly like Kill Bill Volume 1.
Yeah, even more.
Much more.
Yeah, it's true.
And so you wonder with this, and that's certainly the case here, Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows Part 2 gets the best reviews of the whole series.
Right.
It is truly a crowning accomplishment. I would actually compare it as a crowning accomplishment. If you like the Harry Potter movies, this is every bit the equal to Return of the King if you like the Lord of the Rings
oh,
movies.
Excellent.
It is that much of an accomplishment. And, you know, there is talk that it might get an Oscar nomination for Best Picture, one of the 10. And I certainly hope so. It certainly is deserving of it in terms of its accomplishment. The series is deserving of recognition.
Mm-hmm.
And yet they've never really been given the credit that, for example, the Lord of the Rings movies do. And I don't really get that, to
yeah.
be honest.
Yeah,
there's something about the source material of the Harry Potter being maybe aimed at kids that somehow didn't have the weight and the gravitas of the Lord of the Rings. And yet, I'm sorry, I still just see a lot of people playing goblin and dress up on all of them.
Well, there is talk that it's up for your consideration, this final movie. So
we'll see. Although I was at a screening of the Directors Guild with a lot of people who had never seen a Harry Potter before, and the reaction was lukewarm. It was polite, wow. though not enthusiastic. Though I don't know how you could enjoy it without having seen
you know,
the others.
And read the books?
How'd
you get through not reading the books, at least?
Yeah, well, but, you know, again, having watched all these movies now, you can really enjoy them. There is a lot of great work there. It is surprisingly consistent in quality with all these different directors. For the most part, they trend upwards.
Yes.
And
smart.
And the story is weaved very well. In fact, I think it's almost distracting to a point to know what's cut out.
Wow. Then I'm not reading the books anymore.
So anyway, so Harry Potter and the Deathly Hallows 2, quite the achievement.
Fantastic.
And I certainly hope it's Oscar nominated. But you, before we split, we've got about a minute.
What?
We got a couple of announcements real quick. Is there any film that you would particularly recommend that you've seen that people might not have caught? Because we promised we would do this.
Yes, not this week. I'll do it next week.
But we're not. No.
Okay, the week after.
All right, we'll finally save that. We'll shelve that for when they're no longer available for people to see. But you know what is available to see anywhere in Europe, the UK,
yes,
and the USA as of tomorrow.
Tomorrow.
On single disc edition DVD,
yep,
and on two disc edition, collector's edition DVD with more than 80 minutes of bonus.
80
features.
Minutes of bonus.
The documentary on comedy consciousness and conspiracy, The Truth Is Out There, available again anywhere in the UK, the USA, and the EU. Check it out at truth-is-out-there.com. There will still be screenings. There is in the works. I don't know if it's available yet. The digital downloads.
It's in the works.
So many ways to be able to see the films. But if you want those DVDs and you're in the areas that I mentioned, go ahead and order them.
Please do.
Canada will, of course, come at some point later in the year. Australia, we already have in the works. It
yep.
will be coming later in the year. And again, there will be more screenings, including possibly one in Hollywood within
Woo-hoo!
A couple of weeks.
Woo-hoo!
Not Santa Monica.
No.
Hollywood.
Okay.
Until next week.
Oh, no.
You're Dean Haglund.
I'm Dean Haglund.
I'm Phil Lernis. You're at twitter.com/dhaglund.
Yep.
Twitter.com/PhilLernis. We are both on Facebook, facebook.com/ChillPackHollywood. You can find so many episodes of this show, ChillPackHollywood.com, ChillPackHollywood.com. And please write us, ChillPackHollywood@Yahoo.com.
Till then, I'm Dean Haglund. Oh, yeah, we did that. See ya.